Well, we've talked so much about Gene this afternoon that I could almost, I'm tempted to say he needs no introduction. But let me say a few words anyway. Gene, as you know, is one of the most eminent philosophers and psychologists. It's not that long, Gene. In the world today.
No, it's, you're saying good things about me, so then that's difficult for me to hear. But go
well, you don't know yet.
I can tell.
You trust him, I think.
Yes. Facts about Jean are easy to state. He was born in Vienna in 1926. He fled the Nazis and settled the United States in 1939. He entered the University of Chicago in 1948. He worked under Carl Rogers there, received his PhD in 1958. He was a professor of psychology and philosophy at the University of Chicago. In 1962, he wrote a path-breaking book called Experiencing and the Creation of Meaning. In 1970, he was the first person to receive the Distinguished Professional Psychologist of the Year Award from the Clinical Division of the American Psychological Association. He developed an approach to therapy called focusing, based around awareness of a bodily felt sense. He wrote The Process Model, and his Focusing Institute has an elaborate webpage which you can consult for writing some more information. But Gene is more than these facts. And it's this more that explains his influence as one of the most influential philosophers and psychologists today. To talk about this more about Gene is somewhat harder than to list facts, but if Gendlin has taught us anything, it's that we can do it. For according to the process model, we always have a felt bodily sense that's more than what we can say, more than the concepts we have. Furthermore, we can consult and elaborate this felt bodily sense, never exhausting it, always transforming it to come up with more words and concepts. The borders of language are not those of thought and can always be expanded. When the music stops, not only does the dancing continue, but we can use it to elicit more music. Gendlin encapsulates this idea in a now famous image. The image involves a poet stuck in the middle of an unfinished poem. The poem wants more. What it wants more is... The point is that what the poem wants is not blank, not a vacuum, but tells us precisely what does not fit. It's a... When speaking, you use a hand motion, like I just did. On the page, you use an ellipsis, a dot, dot, dot. The dot, dot, dot stand for something more to come, this logic that is not logically implied, but it's not nothing, and in fact is quite precise and changes whenever whatever comes and creates anew. It's a masterful, beautiful image, succinct and appropriate without trivialization. It's a synecdoche for the process model. Those who know Gene know this image by a name. Formally, it is known as the Gendlin ellipsis. Informally, it's known as Gene's dot, dot, dot. This image now gives us a way to address precisely what's more about Gene, to say how it is that he can talk from the same place that he lives, to say why, while some people dispense wisdom, Gene elicits it. To say why, when you're in the same room as he is, you feel smarter, you feel more than you are. To say why he's so influential. And that's as follows. What's more about him? It's that Gene Gendlin gives us back our dots. Again, thank you for coming to this conference on trust, and let us welcome modern philosophy's eminent dot restorer.
That was much better than I expected. Well, first I want to say that this is not my usual voice. It hasn't quite come back yet. I'm recovering from an operation, and I'm really fine. But it'll take a while for everything to get normalized. Next, I want to say that right now, after Bob Scharf and the others, I'm well off. So it's at some risk that I talk at all. If I disappoint you, go right back to whatever Bob and Bob said. So I don't usually use the words trust or truth, because for me, the big words have so many different meanings that what I do when somebody uses, I love the big words too, but when someone uses them, then I always want to know, just here, in this spot, in this sentence, At this juncture, what does this word mean or do for you? If this word could mean just exactly what you mean by it here, what would it mean?
And I ask very gently, what would it mean? I don't say define your term. Because if I ask it very gently, then typically out come three or four very poetic, metaphorical, rich, fresh sentences. And those are very valuable. So that is a method that we've now developed of thinking at the edge. Everything I say is much better on our webpage. So put in focusing and click philosophy and you'll see it all there. So if I'm going to talk about truth, then I have to talk about, first of all, some phrase that I need. For example, the implicit-explicit truth, or the implicit truth that includes also the explication and then still has the implicit with it. Something like that. The implicit-explicit truth. Now, that's only one kind of truth. But truth is at least that. It can be many more things. And this is a formula that I find very handy. I say, well, what I'm talking about is one kind of that. And so then I don't take away anybody's other things. I don't want to take anything away from anybody. And besides, I also have other kinds of truth too, of course. Many operational results of experiments, or there's a kind of truth that when I say, when I'm in conflict, I say to myself, well, what I want is the truth. And that makes me all whole. I don't have any idea what it is, but I'm whole because my wanting is whole. So there are many kinds of truth that I care about. The one that I want to talk to and know the most about is the implicit, explicit two terms you need for this one. And trust, similarly. I don't like trust because people keep saying, trust your feelings. I don't think you should. I can't. And they say, trust other people. Well, I trust other people to be the way that they've been. You know, so however somebody's been, I pretty well trust them to go on. But that's not what they mean by trust. So I don't use that word, but if I were to use it, I would say, then trust not the feelings, but the process. And by the process, for short, trust the process. What I mean is that we want to receive every different feeling. We want to welcome every different feeling, no matter how horrible, gruesome, whatever it may be. Say, oh yeah, there you are. In Afghanistan, where they're teaching focusing, they do it via Rumi, who says that you own a guest house, and every feeling that comes is a guest. And welcome them at the door, no matter what they look like. It's a hospitality concept, you see. And what that means is that you are not your feelings. You're welcoming them. And in welcoming them, you sense yourself as none of those things. You have them. They're guests. You take them in and you give them a room in your guest house. And that's an important kind of I that I may not have time to come back to. It's the kind of I that's, it's self-owned and it's not a content. It has all the content.
So I would say, trust the process by which you can go in and say, now, what is this feeling bringing me more here?
And then you will see that with every feeling goes a larger cloud, sort of. And, ah, yeah, 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 yeah. And if you pay direct attention to that at first unclear larger sense, then little steps come. Oh, you say, that's right, I see how I got that. It was in the... And oh yeah, another thing about it, and oh yeah, it's because of, oh yeah, it reminds me of that, and oh yeah, I need to do this and this. So I would go on and say, there is a process possible with little steps. And that process you can trust. And we can come back later and see where it ends, but you can trust it because at every step you're glad you got that far. Oh, yeah, I see. And so it helps you at each step, even though there are further steps. In that sense, the explicit, implicit truth is never finished. Why would you want it to be finished? This is a question that I ask you. Why do you want to impoverish being to that extent that you want it to finish? It doesn't finish. It creates and creates and creates. It creates us, and through us it creates, and it doesn't finish. Each new person is a whole new ballgame of creation. So why do you want it to be less than that? But even if you do and you know why you want it to be less than that, it won't be. It's going to go right on. Now, I want to say that no concept, no logical form, no shape, I said in my title, no picture, no explicit event is ever going to be the truth. But if you take the explicit event or the concept or the idea or the diagram or whatever it is, if you take it together with where it comes from in you, if you take it together with what some people want to call the context, which is pretty good, everything has an experienced context, that cloud behind the feeling that I was talking about. If you take any explicit, any logical form, any diagram, any picture, any concept together with where it's speaking from, then you have something, some truth, some angle, some entry into what's going on. If you wanted to say, or if I had said, the truth is always implicit, I don't think that's right either. It's always implicit and has already created something from it. But if you go back into the implicit that comes with it, then the implicit becomes more. Oh, this thought that you just had isn't only itself. It opens up where it comes from so that it has made more than if you hadn't had the thought. So we want to respect both the concept and the where it comes from, because the where it comes from develops through the concept, through the creation. And the sharper the concept is, the more it develops. So, as I know you said, the implicit is no invitation to be rounder or stay fuzzy or look down on precise work. Just the opposite. The more precise your concepts are, the more they open the implicit further so that then you have even more to say. But I am saying negatively, no concept, no logical picture, no form is ever directly true of whatever is. There is always an implicit intricacy, I call it. You can call it whatever you want. There is always that. Anything we study is really that. Whatever big word you want, reality, it's always... Is there, whatever we study is modest. Reality is very big. I don't care what you say. The truth, reality, whatever we study, the most smallest specific detail, what Plato meant by this sentence, large or small, it's always an implicit intricacy. But what is implicit intricacy? It's us, in a way, and that thing. So we are always already in interaction with whatever we study, before we start studying it, of course. So that a way of saying this fast is to say interaction is first. Then you sort it out. The implicit intricacy that you live is first. Then you sort it out. But of course, when we go to school, they make us learn all these finished conclusions. And so then we have to recover from that. Most people have to recover from what was called thinking in school. So by this time, people here, you probably already recovered from it. But it is important to see that, unfortunately, we start kids with the concepts first. They're supposed to learn these, and then you're supposed to monitor around with them and rearrange them, but only a little, or they won't get them right. And that way, thinking dies. Fortunately, they don't start school till they're 6 or 5 or now 4 or something terrible. But anyhow, real thinking starts from the implicit intricacy that you already are. And it's an interaction with things. And I'll come back to saying, what about the assumption that reality or whatever we study is already some fixed way, we're just confused about it. I'll be back to that. Trust the process of steps of opening, of explicating. Trust the implicit, explicit truth. So it requires noticing that there is this implicit. Noticing that there is more with it, whatever it is you said or thought. Just go back behind it and say, where did that come from? And don't be scared just because all you have is Now that's something worth talking about. When you first do this, and I don't think that's true of any of you, you probably do it whenever you think anyhow. People who think are accustomed to the fact that the unfinished, uncomfortable, but pregnant sort of is worth more than the 25 things that we could say off the top of our head if we had to say something, right? So maybe that's good enough. But if you don't know about focusing, that's what we call focusing now, is to spend time, and it might be 10 seconds or 20 seconds, to spend time actually attending to this somewhat uncomfortable but pregnant, to know that something can come there. And then something will, and then it's, once it comes, you're glad you didn't go with all the things off the top of your head that you already know. But until it comes, you feel sort of, even after years of doing it, you know so many things, and you're so smart, and you have such beautiful things to say. Do you really have to stand here in front of this gray wall and just be? And the answer is yes. You do. That's the process to trust. Okay. Now, noticing this, I mean in three ways. First, I invite you just to follow me intellectually, because I have general philosophical things to say, and you can follow those. So even if you don't do anything with this focusing stuff, you can follow me when I talk about that. There is always a context, there is always an implicit, and there is an implicit-explicit relation, and there are complicated connections between implicit and explicit, and you can follow me. But secondly, I would say privately inside yourself, do see if it doesn't also apply there, really, to you, where you think, especially where you think about something that you want to think about, something that you have a feel for and you're not finished with, because you can do that right away. And thirdly, I would even invite you to explore either our training or merely my assertion that if you spend a lot of time doing that, the space gets bigger and bigger there. You can do things after a while that you couldn't do at the beginning. There is a deepening that goes on there, and we have even a training for it. And you might even like to know about our training, even if you don't need it, because eventually, never mind. I was going to joke and say you'll send somebody else to it. Now, this business about no conclusion, no concept, no form, no diagram, no shape is ever directly true, I'm asserting, has been a terrible block in philosophy and still is in many circles today. somehow philosophers were taught to believe that philosophy is the conclusions. And it has become understood that no conclusion necessarily holds. So people are running around saying nothing holds. Yeah. You know, there's nothing at the bottom. It's all up to you. You know, even my classes, I used to argue with, you know, any questions, oh, it's up to you, you know. I say, well, if I call you at midnight for advice on a problem, you're going to tell me it's up to me? I know it's up to me. Didn't you go to the University of Chicago? Don't you know something about how to think? I know the conclusion is up. But philosophy, I'm here to say, is not the conclusions. And never was. All the way back to where philosophy, at least what we call philosophy, began back there with Heraclitus and what is it now, 3,500 years ago or something. How far ago? 800 or so BC? Well, it's only... it's less than 3,000 years ago. It's been known that no concept, no set of words, no single thought necessarily holds. Consequently, even to say that doesn't necessarily hold. You see? And that's been understood by philosophers, by all philosophers. So when you read a philosophy, now, there are two things to say. When you read a philosophy, what I advise is go and stand where that philosopher is standing and put yourself into doing what that philosopher is doing. Then you will discover where that philosopher gets the terms from, because every philosopher introduces new terms. They use words like truth and trust and being and beauty and self and all those big words. But they always mean something by it which you don't know right away when you start reading. You have to read quite a bit of it before you say, oh, I see, you know, because the words...
Where does the philosophy get those differently meaning words?
Well, they get them by dipping into the implicit somewhere and coming out of there again. And so you... want to do two things which for me come to the same thing, but you might want to do it differently. So what I'm sure of is to understand the philosophy, stand where that philosopher is standing. And that's true of all of them, not just the most recent one. You go back to Plato and see what he's doing, and you discover, oh, he uses different meanings in each dialogue. Oh, he doesn't believe in the theory of forms that they teach us in school. He has this whole dialogue ridiculing the theory of forms. It's called the Parmenides, and they don't read it. Read the first half of the Parmenides. It's easy to read and it's fun. And Plato is making fun of Platonism there. They say, well, that's not what he's doing. What is he doing? Where does he get his terms? Well, then you see right on the page he gets them. All of a sudden you see everything he's doing is making new terms. Aristotle got a little impatient with him because there's different terms in every few paragraphs. Aristotle decided to save some of the good terms. But you see that when Aristotle did that, he knew why Plato was doing that other thing. So Aristotle puts the terms, but then he says the things are not, don't have the terms in them. Where we have three different things, we say, you know, a human being is an animal and a this and a that. Those things are not in the thing. So again, you say, well, see what I mean? He knows about the implicit intricacy. He's making sure that the terms remain not stupid, not cut off conclusions, not assertions directly of reality or of anything, single thing even. The thing is one, our definite. So it goes on right through philosophy. And if you do that, you learn these tremendously valuable things from these old philosophers. It's not at all true that they are just whatever Heidegger or McKeon or somebody else tells you about them, because that's just one more thing. Okay, I want to combine two things that I already said. When you allow the sharp concepts that these people create when you allow the sharp concepts to work in the implicit, it opens the implicit more. So when you stand in between the assertions and the implicit, you can go from there in ways that that philosopher didn't go. And that's really what's exciting. It's not all that exciting to see what Plato did. It's exciting to see that I can do that too. I can take any concepts and play with them until it opens. And then, and Plato, you know, didn't refuse to write without a fiction, at least a fictional character. For Plato's method, you have to have a person. Because the contradiction doesn't do anything. It just cancels out. You know, you said this, and now see, it comes to that. And you just lost, that's all. The only way you can go on with the dialectic is if you have a person who says, what the hell did I mean? I didn't mean this contradiction. And he goes back in there, and he uses that to improve what he's trying to say. Because the sharpness of the concept opens his implicit. So... Now I have to go very fast and apologize because now I'm going to do something bad. I'm going to just do a lot of assertions, a lot of conclusions, right? But I will say that most of my philosophy is on the webpage. It's all there. You can pull it down. You can give it to anybody. You have my permission to use it in any form whatsoever, or argue with it, do anything with it. Okay, so my second little unit here, today we have constructivism and objectivism, right? And they're both right about each other. They know that they're talking nonsense, but they also know that the opponents are even worse. And so it's okay. But constructivism and objectivism share the assumption that I'm attacking, namely that the organized, clear, conceptual stuff is the only order that there is. And I'm saying, no, the implicit intricacy that we are in interaction with everything, this is a greater order, a more precise order, and a different order, so that if all the concepts and all the objective entities that are measured collapse or change all the time, that's all right, because that's not the only order. So to me, objectivism and constructivism are the same thing. They both assume that you've got to believe, and you can't, these entities, these forms, these concepts, these already finished things, cut off from the making of them. Somebody like Dennett wants to make a computer and then jump into it.
Well, I wish him well.
We would be rid of him. Well, I want to say about trust that science, well, let me say first, the habits of philosophy, well, I don't know if there is such a thing as bad philosophy. That's not really philosophy. But the habits that that people have, they're in the habit of taking the conclusion as if there has to be a conclusion by itself, and oh my God, there isn't, that you can trust. And so also the objectivists, so-called, the people who want to say, trust science, want you to trust this year's science. Last year already they said something else, and next year they're going to say a lot more in different terms. So obviously, you know, trust the science of 100 years from now, or, as my slogan goes, trust the process. The process of science you can trust, actually. But if you look closely, you see that science doesn't trust its concepts. They're all busy changing them right now. Science trusts the results of experiments. Well, what is an experiment? An experiment is an interaction. It's like you build something out of your concepts, but then is that wonderful cartoon a couple of years ago. There's this man and a very hesitant woman standing, and the whole place is full of huge machinery and computers, and she's got the plug in her hand, and she says, "Well, I guess since we have to plug it in, we're still in control." So an experiment is taking the best that we know right now, the explicit concepts, build the machines from it, the entities that we know, is taking that and putting it into action. In reality, you want to say, or in the world, or in nature, maybe, whatever word you like for that. In the truth, we could say, because one meaning of truth, always at least one meaning of those big words, one meaning of truth is that we live in the truth already. You know. Then what we say might be false, but we already live in the truth. So we don't want to treat nature as if it were only something out there that we puzzle about. By that time, we're adult, or as one of my friends says about Piaget, he thinks the child is a little scientist all by himself. No, we live, period. There's already the truth, and there's already interaction. But when the scientists take their conclusions and their machines and turn them on, and Bob, where did you go, has these delightful stories about this, which maybe we'll tell one later. What then happens can surprise you. And it can surprise you not only in the terms that you wanted to be surprised, it can also surprise you in a totally different way. It can blow up, or it can make noise, or it can do all kinds of different things. So that even though they don't call it that, for science too, interaction is primary. Then I have a very careful, very hard-to-read paper called The Responsive Order, in which I argue that this should be taken into how we think about empiricism. Instead of some people saying you trust the results and some people saying, no, you made up the hypotheses, so therefore you can't trust anything. That's not true. None of my constructivist friends would like to get on an airplane that wasn't tested. You know? Even though that can crash too, of course we know that. So then we test it, you know, then we build further and we think further and we try this and we try that and we make new words and new things and we do more and more, and pretty soon the old stuff doesn't work anymore, and then you've got a new set of terms. And if you go back and look for what was true 30 years ago, you can't even find it in the library. It's over in the history of science section, because now the terms are all completely different. So trust the process, I'm saying, and don't mind the fact that it's never finished, because why do you want it finished? But I do have to say one more thing, and my time is going away, so I better say it real fast. There is an error that pervades Western philosophy. It's the error of thinking that the map, the finished concepts, the clarity, is basic to the operations. I'm arguing that the operations are basic and the clarity changes every few years. But they want to say it because the clarity explains. So you have to look and see what explains is. And I haven't got time to go into it, but you all have the experience of what explains is. And it's a very precious experience. Oh, you say, that's how it works. Yes, the concepts are very precious. Yes, the machines are very precious. Because they explain and they let us do things. Right? We couldn't be 6 billion people on this earth right now if it weren't for science and all the machines and all the explaining. So the explaining is extremely legitimate. It's just that it changes every few years, and the interaction is what controls change. So you have to know that the scientific concepts and the entities and what we build and what we make is very precious and very legitimate. It's just that you can't forget that you're here too, and that all the science is going on in this wider context. And every scientist really knows that because they try to revise every theory when it doesn't work. And what do they do when they revise a theory? Well, they focus. You know, they go in and say, now what else do I know here and how can I find a way that still correlates everything else? And so forth. They don't have a lot to say about that. But the mistake I want to point to, the big mistake is to think the map is basic to the operations. But that's very technical. The mistake I'm talking about is that logic is precious, right? It's sacred. It creates. But it depends on the units. To have logic, you have to already have these discrete entities that have nothing inside but themselves, sort of like. They're all made of lead or butter right through them. And they have only external relations. Logic, the way it is understood, and I question that, but logic, the way it is understood, is only external relations, also known as formal relations. Much of Western philosophy wants to know why logic and mathematics, which is also like logic, why it applies to nature. Well, it applies because we make entities, and we make entities and build the world with it, so don't put that down. But we make them, so pay attention to the making of the entities, the making of the logical units, the way we unitize so that we can then use logic. And so I'm saying both that it's legitimate and sacred, and also that it happens within the wider interaction that we are already before we even start to think. After all, we don't only study things, we also walk around on things, right? And we live with things, and we eat things, and we inhale things. We don't just only observe them or interpret them. The interaction is always first. Now I want to tell you that I have a great deal of detail. First of all, the basic, here I can just throw things out and stop. The basic terms need to be different. And I have what is perhaps a crude, but after all, the first, I always say this about Heidegger, but now I'm going to say it about myself. I always say about Heidegger, well, pioneers can't give you finished products. So take where he opens things and don't worry about the fact that he contradicts himself someplace and falls back in again. Well, that's what you expect from pioneers. So treat my process model the same way, please. It's the first attempt, and it works to some extent, to set up primitive terms that are both implicit and explicit. The basic terms of which I start are implying and occurring. That we can start without assuming static is as this. That we can start with a living process instead of is-as that we interpret in various ways. It's it. Well, it. Reality, nature, you, me, the dog, anything we study, one sentence of Plato's, anything, it is both a particular shape and an implicit, an implied. If you start with something that's both, then the terms are different than the usual terms. And yet, I have a way of reducing it back to the usual terms if you need to link with all the data that we have, that's all couched in the usual terms. With that model, I can do a lot of things. One of the things I can do, I mean, I'm going to talk very fast now, is to derive the way we make logical units. And that's chapter 7, but I recommend you looking at it because it's my favorite chapter. I can derive the empty space and these entities, these closed fixed entities. These entities, you know, they only move because they're patterned. And you have to think of what is actually a logical form or a pattern. And a pattern is something that can move just as the pattern and ignore everything else. And when it ignores everything else, it makes something interesting. When a pattern moves from this to that, you see, the monkeys can't figure out how to even make a length out of two sticks that fit into each other. They begin to, they're close to us, but they can't. Whereas a person says, oh, this is too far for this stick, and they don't fit, I need something this long, and can think this thing that's this long, and looks up in the tree and says, oh, there's one, and pulls it down and strips it off and has a length. What is that? Well, that's a pattern, by which I mean it ignores the leaves, and it ignores all the tree, and it ignores everything, and it just moves the pattern from here where it's missing to there where I see it. You following me? Now that's how things only move. Everybody that I have read assumes that only moving is basic. But only moving is not basic. Only moving is a human symbolic creation, a very complicated mathematical creation in which you're dealing with quantities, with length, with patterns. And I can derive that, or I have, or if you don't like how I did it, you can do it better. It's important to know, though, that the empty space and the linear time are not basic. Well, Heidegger already said that, and so did many other people. But I will say this. We do as a society, maybe you don't, but we as a society need to understand logic and the creation of lengths and of empty space and so forth. We need to understand it because we have no way right now to use science. There are people who, you know, they prefer 25 herbs mixed as long as they don't know what they are because they won't have anything to do with science. And then there are the other people who trust science and think that they themselves are the neurological cell firings. You know what I mean? Well, I'm here to say no, no. You're not the atoms and you're not the organic chemistry that people said I was when I was a student. And now you're not the neurology either, dear. Those are unit screens, unit creations. But we're very grateful for them, and they can cure things that we couldn't cure before, so I'm not putting it down. No, no, no. 20 years from now, they'll have an even different screen. But we need a society-wide understanding because the critique alone is helpless. We've had the critique now for 100 years or more, and logic has gone on and changed the entire world right under our feet. Changed how we write our critique even on the computers now, right?
How do my friends critique science electronically?
Anyway, we need to understand both the legitimacy and the limitations of logic and science so that we can use them as a society instead of each person sort of fumbling around.
Would I rather have a tea of 24 mixed herbs or go to the doctor?
Well, I have to say that I have a lot of methodological stuff, some of which you might like, about how the implicit and the explicit carry each other forward, what they do to each other, what happens to dialectic, what happens to logic, what happens to various other ways of conceptualizing if you put them into this zigzag where you increase the implicit by the sharp concepts, and then you come up with new sharp concepts. You might want to see some of that. I want to say again that having just looked at stuff about being and truth, that being and truth can't very well be much less than you and me are, don't you think? The universe can't possibly just be an external something observed from a distance, because we're here. And where would this be? I mean, isn't this the universe too? So, anything really that you take, not just the big universe, anything, any little thing, opens up into all sorts of possibilities that go further. this creativity is never finished. And it shouldn't be. Now, I think a really simple way is to say some people want to blame concepts or language for getting stuck. And you all know what that's like, because we have a beautiful thought and we tell it to a certain person and we analyze it and it's dead and we go home and wonder what we thought was so exciting. That happens. But it also happens the other way. There's that rare person where if you tell it to them, it opens up, and then there's more, and then there's still more, and then you think of more, and then you wonder, did you have all that at the beginning? Well, both of these can happen, and they're both language. So the power of language to open things up, to make fresh sentences from what seemed to you vague, is what I want to emphasize. So don't blame language. There's a lot of this stuff now where they think language just consists of the public meanings. And so if you say anything, then you have fallen into language. And this is very stylish to say, but I think it's very dumb, because, you know, didn't this person ever say something fresh from what they felt or thought or experienced or saw or lived or what? Because if you do that, it comes out metaphorical. It comes out words, same 600,000 English words, but saying new things, new combinations, new ways, and you can do that. The way to prevent it from killing is to check inside every moment. Does this carry forward what I had there? And if it says, no, 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 say, okay, never mind, throw that out. I didn't mean that. Then it recovers. And then after a while, you say another thing, you say, okay, that's not even. And you think with the not yet spoken. And of course, all the words that come, until you get one that takes it, carries it further. And that's the one you keep. Then you go on from there. If you do that, then it never kills it. Follow me? Even with a person who doesn't understand it, you go back and you say, there, you know, like with a child, you say, there, that man doesn't understand, that's okay, let's go this way. And protect your beginning place there. We have a very well worked out set of steps called Thinking at the Edge, which I would like you to look at. We teach those steps. Once you know the steps, of course, to hell with the steps. Same with focusing or anything else. Steps are for teaching. They're to help a person find it. Once they find it, see, that's why I don't like Gendlin's, whatever you said. No, it can't be Gendlin's ... because it's yours and there is nobody else has it. Oh yeah, that's another thing. Many of us are terribly private and shy about what we think, and that's fine. But you do have to know that if you don't think from there, it's lost. Because nobody else has your ... Now that may burden you with responsibility or excite you. I don't know, but it's true. Each person is a different take. Leibniz already said it very well. Each person is a different take on whatever you study, that sentence or the universe or whatever it is. Okay, now I have 2 minutes to say, back to, I want to just own that I come from, and I made a list, and of course it's incomplete, but again, it's at least. And where's my list? It's here somewhere. Oh, I know where it is. It's right there. I come at least from Plato, Aristotle, Leibniz, Kant, pragmatism, like Dewey, Diltai, Whitehead, Husserl, Heidegger, Sartre, Merleau-Ponty, and Wittgenstein. Without any of those, I couldn't be here this way. And there's probably more than at least those. And I have learned different things from them, not the same thing. But they all dip into the implicit in a way that you might want to see. And more important, where they stand will open up for you more than they say and more than I say. So I think it wants to be my last message here, and I'm on 10, to say, don't treat a philosopher as a bunch of conclusions cut off from the process. That isn't philosophy. Philosophy is a way of coming from. It's a way of opening where we come from. It's a way of dealing with the fact that you can't ever really say anything if you're going to take what you say as the final conclusion. That's been known throughout philosophy. So you want to know, how does this philosopher deal with that? What was this philosopher's strategy? Where did this philosopher dip in and come out to get those new terms? Or, you know, did Heidegger just sit down and type out being in time? And then you should start with that. Because if you do that, then these philosophers become alive, and philosophy becomes alive, and you become alive. And again, people who came to this, you're already thinking, but so many people rediscover thinking. They haven't had thinking since they were 4 or 3 or something in our TAE. They rediscover thinking, and they're so excited because they can think, and they wanted always to be able to, and they couldn't. So let any philosopher, if you already mastered any one text, then take that one, of course, because the sharper you've mastered it, the more it will do. And let it show you where it comes from, because that's also what it opens. And there you can think further. Heidegger pleaded with people to do this, and just what I'm saying, please think, you know, please think further, please think further. When Fring started the Heidegger Circle, Heidegger was still alive, he wrote Fring's a letter and said, please don't call it the Heidegger Circle. Please call it the Circle for the Question of Being, or the Question of What Is, or something like that. Of course, it was called the Heidegger Circle. And it repeats what Heidegger said year in, year out, except for references to current events or other philosophers. You could shuffle the papers, and they're all about Heidegger's finger. If you see what I mean. Well, it's very important to study his finger, because his finger points, and by his finger I mean the precise concepts that he laid down. It's very valuable to study the precision of those concepts, but it's also deadly to cut them off from where that whole thing is pointing. And that's why he kept saying that. He said a philosopher can't jump over his own shadow. He meant himself. He said, it's too much to ask of me to now overcome what I've brought. I can't do that. You have to do that. So I want to say orthodoxy in that sense is very important and precious, because it keeps the precision, but it also kills what it preserves. So we need both, okay? We need to go on from where these philosophers have opened things, and we also need to, of course, preserve them or keep them so that other people can go on from them. And there I stop. Right on time.
Precisely on time, Gene, which opens up the implicit again.
Well, but of course it's good old linear time. It's a human creation. Is it a human creation?
It isn't anything.
Anyway, give me trouble, please.
Thank you for the talk, first of all. And there are 2 points I have. First, this conference is about trust.
Wait a minute.
You have to take that.
Yes.
And then that's, so.
Yes.
I was just wondering if that's a good way of thinking about trust also, in a way of
yes.
Thinking about trust.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, well, I could add to that, but yes.
Okay.
I would say, yes, I sign what he's saying. Yes, I'm arguing that you can trust philosophy if you take it as the process. And yes, what you said is important there. It takes a graduate student in philosophy about a year or two to figure out even what philosophy is. And that's how it is. It's like difficult to get on this meta level where you're really thinking about concepts. You don't have any concepts. You're thinking about them. Philosophy is very peculiar. It isn't about anything, it seems. So I don't know if you meant that, but there was
it's about itself. It's about itself in a very important way.
Yes, you're trusting the process of you figuring out what the hell philosophy even is. And I'd say yes to that process. Because by the time you say fancy things, you've done a lot of trusting already. Yes.
Gene, you talked a lot about, I was struck in this marvelous speech that really puts together so much of your thought. One theme that kept coming up is where you stand, where you're coming from, even you added at the very end where you're aiming at. Could you say more about that adverb, that where? Because, of course, we know it's not definite location. It isn't a particular point. On the other hand, it is a highly spatial term, and it's very striking to be used so often. So it does imply something about, let's call it the space of thought, something like that, you know, the spatiality of thought. And I'd like to hear, well, why do you think you spontaneously chose that word, and on other occasions you often speak this way, but I'd just like to hear a little more about that, because philosophers normally talk as if what they're doing has no space, you know, no particular location at all, as if they could free themselves entirely from this and say something that's always true or, you know, true without qualification, true without location, true without the where.
Yes. Oh, that's lovely. And it's a nice question from you also. Since it's about space and the space that we livingly create, this one too, and so but I have two or three different, not one shape answer to that. First, I would say yes. There is a location, first of all, of my discomfort, my excitement, my whatever I want, but my felt sense of whatever I'm saying. So he's asking me about space, so I know, yes, space. Well, let's divide into 3 points. Okay, well, I'll take that one. So I say, oh, yeah, it starts here, somewhere in the middle. In this ordinary space of the fellow sitting in the chair, here. It's absolutely located. Then, as I pay attention to it, it turns out to have its own space and a very different space. Now it can be hiding under a rock over here and be a little scared thing, or it can be a thing much larger than the fellow in the chair, which also shows that the space of thinking is not identical to. It's not actually my physical viscera, although we don't know what it would be like without that yet, but it's not, it's its own space. And that space is very interesting, and as you do more focusing or whatever, exploring that, you find that space is a very distinct place. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody knows that place when it pipes up, but that's sometimes rare for people. You know, like you have a job offer or an apartment or something, and it's perfect, but something says, you're well advised not to take that job, right? Even though you don't know why. Now, with focusing, you can go in there and find out why, which is a big advantage, but or at least some of why. But there is a distinct where that's different than my concept thought capacity. And to do this well, and again, more than half the people in this room have already done that, you need to make peace between these two. It's like for me, from a very long time already, I know that they can't knock each other out. My intellect is allowed to think anything under the sun, no matter what it is, however critical or nasty or romantic or whatever it wants to think, it can think that. But it can't knock this one out. And this one can't knock that one out either. Because I'm blind without that one, I hope that, and I'm blind without this one. So they, I need them both. This one is always the implicit coming up with a little step. Those little steps are so different from what it makes up here. You know, up here I have three things and I say, oh, they go together. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Down here it says, wait. I say, what's the matter? It says, well, these two go together, but this one is way far away. And there's a lot between that you don't know yet. So I respect that. I have to. There's a different quality to what comes in that space. It's much finer. And it includes what I don't know yet. And if I think with it, then I can think better. Both of them. So, okay, you know, I see that little scheme of those three, but that'll have to wait. And that one up there is accustomed to waiting because that one's so fast. And this one is a little slower, but also very fast, but slower. So that space, now it, there was a third point which I've lost. And I may not get it back, but what was it?
So I have learned now.